Hi, this is Gabe, and I wanted to note before the episode that the audio quality of my side of the discussion that follows is subpar. I apologize for the annoyance of that, and we'll get it fixed going forward.
Welcome to episode 9 of Oklahoma Appeals, the podcast. I'm Gabe Bass, and I'm here with my co-host, former staff attorney at the Oklahoma Supreme Court, and current appellate advocate, Jana Knott. And on today's show, we're going to review opinions of the Court of Civil Appeals that were issued from August 2020 through the end of the year. We previously covered all of the other published opinions of the Court of Civil Appeals on other episodes of the show. But we have 11 cases that we have not yet discussed, and today we're going to talk about five of those cases in some detail and then give you short summaries of the other six.
That's right. So first, I want to update our listeners on a little bit of news coming from the Court of Civil Appeals. On December the 18th, just a couple of weeks ago, Governor Stitt appointed Judge Thomas Prince to the Court of Civil Appeals to fill a vacant position, and Judge Prince previously served on the Oklahoma County District Court bench since 2012. The Court of Civil Appeals also issued an order several weeks ago noting that Judge Barbara Swinton is appointed as the Chief Judge of the Court of Civil Appeals for 2021, and Judge Fisher will serve as the Vice Chief Judge of the Court of Civil Appeals for 2021.
All right, and with that update on news from our appellate courts, we'll move into our review of some of these recent opinions. So we'll start with 2020 OK Civ App 56, which is Davidson versus Point Vista Development. This case was decided back on May 12th of this year by Division 2 of the Court of Civil Appeals. And just as a quick reminder, these cases are not published usually for several months in some cases after the decision is actually made by the Court of Civil Appeals, but because of potential petitions for cert to the Supreme Court and other post-decision actions, the cases are not actually published and issued on oscn.net until mandate issues in the case, and that's usually several months after the decision is handed down. So again, this one was issued on or the case was decided rather on May 12, 2020, but only recently was it published and available on OSCN. Again, this was Division 2 of the Court of Civil Appeals, and they are looking at a decision coming out of Marshall County. This case is an appeal from summary judgment in the trial court. And the facts are that Point Vista Development contracted with the state of Oklahoma to purchase certain property in Lake Texoma State Park, and this was part of Point Vista's planned resort development on Lake Texoma. Well, included in that property that they contracted to purchase, some of the property was already under lease, and one such tract was under lease to a park concessionaire, that's Davidson in this case. They had previously operated a fun park on the property that Point Vista was going to acquire. The park was, I believe, no longer in operation, the fun park, but Davidson still held the lease. This all started back in 2008 when Point Vista Development and Davidson entered into an agreement that said that Point Vista Development would purchase the lease from the Davidsons when they closed on the purchase of the underlying land from the state of Oklahoma. The Davidson's lease actually was set to expire in 2021, which was 13 years out from 2008 when the parties made this deal. Well, the agreement was amended multiple times and the closing delayed multiple times. And key to the outcome in this case is that the agreement between Point Vista and the Davidsons had a provision in it that allowed Point Vista to terminate the contract upon notice to Davidson. There was no period of advance notice required. In other words, sometimes you'll see termination provision that says that one party may, upon 30 days notice to the other, terminate the contract. No verbiage like that in this case, just a right of Point Vista to terminate the contract upon notice to Davidson. Well, this agreement was scheduled to close on December 31st, 2016, and it didn't close. And in 2018, Davidson brings this lawsuit and seeks to specifically enforce the contract and force Point Vista to close on this lease. And in the alternative, they sought damages for Point Vista's failure to close. And they claim that Point Vista never provided any kind of notice that they were terminating the agreement. They just simply didn't close. Now, Point Vista argues that they did actually provide notice, but that it was that's not a material fact to the result in the case, which I assume they took that position to avoid a factual dispute, which would have precluded summary judgment that they were seeking. So Point Vista says, we did provide notice, but even if we didn't, it doesn't matter. The result's the same. We had the absolute right to terminate this contract, and they can't force us to perform a contract that we had the right to terminate. And also, the Davidson's damages would be limited to whatever we would have been required to pay to terminate the contract, which on the terms of the contract was nothing. So Davidson has no damages, and therefore they have no claim. The trial court sides with Point Vista and grants summary judgment, and Davidson appeals. Of course, the standard of review here will be de novo because an appeal of a motion for summary judgment. And the court's analysis in this case is that the contract at issue did give Point Vista Development the right to terminate at any time, and nothing in the contract provides that that right to terminate was cut off as of the closing date. So essentially, Point Vista Development could still terminate the contract after the lawsuit was filed if they wanted to, and pursuant to the terms of the contract itself, there's no monetary penalty or payment that Davidson's entitled to if Point Vista Development were to terminate. So when a contract is terminable by either party without compensation to the other, the damage sustained by the party claiming damages is limited to the amount that they are entitled to under the contract. And in this case, they were entitled to nothing in the event of termination by Point Vista. So they have no damages. And therefore, the trial court's granting of Point Vista Development's motion for summary judgment is affirmed. And this is a 3-0 opinion written by Judge Barnes. And petition for cert was unanimously denied by the Supreme Court. So mandate has issued, and that is the end.
Okay, so the next case we're going to talk about is 2020 OK Civ App 59 in the matter of the estate of White House. And this case was decided on June 8th of 2020, but mandate did not issue until November 19th of 2020. So this is an appeal coming to the Court of Civil Appeals from Pittsburgh County. And the facts of this case are that man and wife are married, holding themselves out as married, and he is killed in a motorcycle accident in August of 2018. And his common law wife, Ms. Burris, petitioned the court for letters of administration in the probate proceeding. She argued that she was his common law wife and that she was entitled to be the personal representative of the estate. So husband's sister objected to the wife's appointment as the personal representative of the estate. And so once the objection was filed, then the parties gathered evidence and proceeded to trial on the issue only of whether she was his common law wife. And so the evidence presented by the wife was that the parties had been together since about 2002, and they had moved into wife's home around 2003, and that's where they lived until 2014 when wife's house burned down. They then moved into an RV, and while the house was rebuilt, and lived there for several years, I believe until he passed away. So during the time, based on the facts recited by the Court of Civil Appeals, it appears that during the time the couple was living in the RV, things got a little rough. And so wife told husband he could leave anytime he wanted to. He didn't have to stay if he didn't want to live there anymore. And he told her he wasn't going to do that because they would have to get a divorce. And apparently this conversation took place around 2014. And so after that conversation, from then on, they held themselves out as a married couple. So he was added to her retirement account as the beneficiary and was named as her spouse. And they filed taxes together jointly, and they maintained joint checking accounts and had multiple vehicles together on several applications, including insurance and cell phone application. They listed each other as their spouses. After he was in the motorcycle accident, she took him to the emergency room, and she was listed as the wife on the medical intake form as well. So Ms. Burris paid for his funeral, and he was buried in a joint burial plot that they're eventually going to share. So those were the facts in favor of a common law marriage. And the sister objected and put on evidence that, and this is coming, this is a quote from the Court of Civil Appeals, to contest Ms. Burris's status, the sister presented evidence of husband's reputation as a tomcat or womanizer. He did not wear a wedding ring, and his Facebook status reflected that he was single. Apparently, there were multiple women that testified that they had had sexual relationship with husband over the course of several years, and that he had told them that Ms. Burris was just his roommate. So some conflicting testimony was given at trial. The trial court takes the case under advisement and decides that Ms. Burris and the decedent did have a common law marriage, that she presented clear and convincing evidence of that. So the sister appeals, and the order that's being appealed is, it's an interlocutory probate order, which we've talked about before, but it's essentially, before the rest of the probate can proceed, they're allowed to appeal this, the appointment of the wife as the personal representative. So the standard of review, as we've talked about in probate cases, is against the clear weight of the evidence, meaning that significant deference is given to the trial court. And even though the Court of Civil Appeals will take a look at the entire factual record and reweigh those facts, they're not going to reverse unless it's against the clear weight of the evidence. So this is an opinion from Judge Hickson at the Court of Civil Appeals. And really, I think what the legal issue is in this case, in which she does a pretty good job of discussing and going back through and taking a look at the Supreme Court's common law marriage case law. The issue is that there were several cases that set forth originally what were called five elements that you have to take a look at and prove in order to find that there's a common law marriage. And so over the development of the case law, the last three elements, the court has said, well, we don't think you necessarily have to prove these. We just think these are more like factors, and you can present evidence, of these three things. So that's the argument from the sister on appeal, is that, look, these five things are elements, and wife had to prove all of the elements of this in order to win on a common law marriage analysis. And the Court of Civil Appeals says, no, you know, we think that the last several factors in this are factors, and you can present evidence and the trial court can consider that and weigh it in making his or her decision. So the Court of Civil Appeals says that the trial court correctly weighed these factors and took evidence on all of them, and that there were, you know, witnesses who testified inconsistently, and that credibility issues were apparent in the record. There's a footnote from the Court of Civil Appeals indicating that when some of the witnesses testified, they had actually outstanding warrants pending for their arrest, prior convictions. So the Court of Civil Appeals says, look, you know, there's conflicting testimony here, but it's for the trial judge to determine credibility of these witnesses. And we're not going to reverse on a case like that, because the trial court's in the best position to make those determinations. And so the other issue that kind of is running through this opinion, the trial court actually made a finding in his order that determined that the decedent's sexual promiscuity did not cancel the marriage that the parties had agreed to in 2014. And the Court of Civil Appeals agreed. They looked at a couple of cases and said, we don't see anywhere where the court has said that, you know, an affair or something like that will cancel a common law marriage. So the Court of Civil Appeals affirmed in a 3-0 opinion, and the Supreme Court denied cert on October the 12th, 8-1, with a dissent from Justice Roe.
The next case that we're going to talk about is 2020 OK Civ App 57, decided by Division 2 of the Court of Civil Appeals on October the 2nd, 2020. This is Grillo Ventures versus Vu. And this is an appeal of a motion to dismiss coming out of Oklahoma County. So because this is an appeal of a granted motion to dismiss, this is an accelerated an appeal and no briefing beyond the trial court record. So the facts in this case are interesting. In 2002, a party named Finley purchased an undeveloped lot near Oklahoma City's recently revived Plaza District at a tax sale, and they paid $388.84 for this undeveloped lot back in 2002. That's how much was owed in delinquent property taxes, which means they probably hadn't been paid in quite some time, because I would imagine an undeveloped lot in the Plaza District in 2002 was probably not racking up a very big property tax bill every year. So the Finleys then, who had purchased this lot for property taxes in 2002, they failed to pay property taxes from 2015 to 2018, which is curious because this is certainly during the period of time that a lot of redevelopment is happening in the Plaza District, and the lot is certainly probably worth more by far than what they paid for it back in 2002. So the county provides notice to Finley that the property is going to be sold by tax sale, and that the sale is going to occur on June the 10th of 2019. And the notice was sent out to the Finleys on April the 4th of 2019. So a mere, I guess, 16 days after this notice gets sent out, the Finleys sell the property to Vu by warranty deed for $38,000 in cash, in what the Court of Civil Appeals describes as a sale that appears to have been a rather informal affair without any title search conducted, et cetera. So Vu pays $38,000 in cash for the property that is about to be sold for taxes. Well, Grillo Ventures then buys the lot at tax sale for $83,000. And the amount of taxes owed were $986.35. So the difference, or a little over $82,000, is excess proceeds payable to, quote, the record owner of such land as shown by the county records as of the date the said county resale begins. That comes to us from Title 68 of the statute, section 3131C. And the way a tax sale works is that the property is auctioned off And then if there are excess proceeds, as there were in this case, that money gets held for 1 year. And if it's not claimed by the prior owner, then the money is essentially forfeited to what's something called the County Resale Property Fund. Well, that doesn't happen in this case, because a mere 19 days after the sale to Grillo Ventures, Finley, who you may remember had originally bought the lot for taxes back in 2002, and a couple weeks before the tax resale, had sold it to Vu for $38,000 in cash. Well, Finley shows up at the treasurer's office and says, "I would like my $82,000. and apparently performing no meaningful title check of any kind, the county treasurer releases the $82,000 to the prior owner, Finley.
Oh boy.
Yes. Vu then sues the county and says, "Hey, that $82,000 should have been mine, and you paid it to this crook Finley," and asked the trial court to issue writ of mandamus directing the county treasurer to pay the $82,000 to Vu, and also sued for a money judgment on some type of a tort theory. Well, the county filed a motion to dismiss and said, "We can't be mandated to pay over money we don't have. We already gave this money to Finley." And also, Vu didn't file a Government Tort Claim Act. So they don't have any standing to sue us for tort, because they haven't complied with the requirements of the Government Tort Claims Act. And the trial court agrees and dismisses Vu's claims. So this goes up to the Court of Civil Appeals. Of course, first the Supreme Court assigns it to the Court of Civil Appeals, and they review this de novo because they're reviewing an order of dismissal. So no briefing by the parties. This will be decided on the record in the trial court as of the petition in error. Well, one of the issues that the Court of Civil Appeals looks at is the phrase "record owner" as it appears in Title 68 OS Section 3131C. As I mentioned, that statute says that if there are excess proceeds from a tax sale, meaning the difference between what the property is purchased for at auction and the amount of taxes that are owed, then that money should be paid over to the record owner of such land as shown by the county records on the day of the resale. Well, in this case, if you want to look at the records in the county clerk's office where real estate records are generally found, you would have seen on the date of the resale that Vu owned the property at that time. Grillo Ventures purchased it at the tax sale, but Vu for a couple of months at that point had been the record owner of the property because Vu had purchased it from Finley back on April 20th. And so the tax sale then takes place on June 10th. Well, it apparently is the practice, or was the practice at this time, of the treasurer's office to look at their records in their office to see who they show is the prior owner and to release the excess proceeds from the tax sale to whomever their records say owns the property. So there was a discussion of what does record owner mean? And the Court of Civil Appeals says, well, we think that clearly means the record owner as per the county clerk records, not the treasurer's records or the assessor's records. But they do acknowledge that their discussion of whose county records we should be relying on is just obiter dicta, which is a judge's incidental expression of opinion and not essential to the decision and not establishing precedent, simply an incidental remark. And they say that it is just obiter dicta because Vu loses regardless of whose records are supposed to be looked at to determine who to pay the excess proceeds to, because either way, the county does not have the excess proceeds anymore. They paid them to Finley, and they can't be mandated to do something that's impossible to do. The Court of Civil Appeals quotes from Town of New Wilson v. Davis, a 1938 Oklahoma Supreme Court case, that says that mandamus will not lie to compel the performance of the impossible. So they can't mandate an impossible act, so there's no way they can issue a writ of mandamus for the county to pay money that it doesn't have anymore. And also, Vu admitted in the underlying case that she didn't comply with the Government Tort Claim Act and didn't seek reversal of the dismissal of her tort claim in the appeal. So that issue was moot. And they affirm the trial court in a 3-0 opinion, Judge Bay Mitchell authors. And of note, recently appointed Judge Pemberton of the Court of Civil Appeals writes a specially concurring opinion and takes issue with how the majority applies or more to his point, fails to apply the rules of statutory construction when it analyzes this issue of record owner as shown by the county records and what county records are we talking about. And Judge Pemberton says, hey, you know, we should have engaged in a more formal analysis if we're going to render an opinion about the interpretation of the statute. The Supreme Court has given us the steps we need to go through. We didn't, but I concur in the opinion because it doesn't change the outcome, and it was just obiter dicta. So I'm going to write specially just to make my point on that, but still 3-0 opinion, trial courts affirmed. Interestingly, there was no petition for cert filed in the case, so mandate issued, and that case is over. The Court of Civil Appeals did suggest to the Oklahoma County Treasurer that they should be engaging in some type of title check before they issue excess proceeds of a tax sale, just to guard against this type of a situation where the owner of the sold property may have changed between the time the county sent out the notice and the time of the actual tax sale.
Okay, next up we have 2020 OK Civ App 62. This case is Lynn versus Oklahoma Farm Bureau Mutual Insurance. And this is a case coming out of Grady County. The opinion from the Court of Civil Appeals was issued back in April 7th, 2020, but mandate did not issue until December 2nd of 2020. So, I mean, I feel like this one, you might want to get some popcorn, prop your feet up, because we got some drama here. Okay, so the plaintiffs in this case, the Lynns, ran what's called a cattle stalker operation, and courtesy of the American Hereford Association's website, a stalker operation is where young calves go to beef up, pun intended there. Okay, so they go there to put on weight before they are then sent to their next destination, the feedlot. So the plaintiffs in this case run the stalker operation, okay? And they specifically purchase calves that are between 400 and 450 pounds. They feed them until they're about 700 pounds, and then they sell them by the pound, okay? So in 2012, the National Livestock Credit Union takes over with their financing. So that's who their bank is. And during a quarterly inventory by the bank that was conducted back in the summer of 2013, the bank officer who is doing the investigation discovers that there are as many as 500 head of cattle missing from the operation. And these cattle were never located. And so the plaintiffs in the case, the Lynns, have an insurance policy with Oklahoma Farm Bureau. And the policy specifically covers the loss of cattle by theft. And the pertinent language here that the parties are fighting about is the loss is only covered if the theft was likely. So the plaintiffs file a claim with Oklahoma Farm Bureau back in August of 2013. Farm Bureau does not pay the claim because they don't believe that the theft was likely. They apparently have a Texas Ranger come up and he does an investigation of the missing cattle, and he determines that he doesn't think that there's 500 total missing. He thinks the number is closer to like 200. But the plaintiffs are still upset because he doesn't actually, I don't think, go out and look at the operation. He simply takes a look at their, at the plaintiff's books and determines that, you know, he doesn't think they've been stolen. If so, it's less than that. So plaintiffs say, well, even so, you didn't do a reasonable investigation and your math was wrong. So we still think we're entitled to, you know, the insurance on this claim. And Farm Bureau says we're not paying it. And so the plaintiff's business goes under because of this. The stalker operation fails. And in February of 2014, they file suit against Oklahoma Farm Bureau for breach of contract and bad faith. So,
okay. So let me see if I get this right. So
this ought to be good.
Yeah. The bank goes out to check on their collateral to verify that the money they've been loaning to this operation to buy cattle is actually being spent on cattle and that there are cattle out there. And the bank officer discovers that there are 500 missing cattle. And then I guess the operator says, oh, wow, you're right. Wow, somebody must have stolen 500 of our cows. We better turn in an insurance claim on this.
This is what I understand. Yes.
Okay. All right. Continue.
So then the Texas Ranger comes in and he looks at everything. Yeah. And he says he can find no evidence of theft. And so Farm Bureau says we're not paying the claim. So that's how we get to bad faith and breach of contract.
And they went out of business because they didn't get their insurance claim filed, not because they didn't notice that they had 500 cattle apparently missing until the bank discovered it for them.
This is true. So I told you it's a good one. So, yeah. Okay. So, and again, this is one of those cases where you think about what dates that we're talking about here. The cattle were lost, stolen, whatever you want to call it, in 2013. Suit was filed in 2014. Here we are, the first day of 2021, just now getting this opinion from the Court of Civil Appeals, and it's finalized. So, you know, 6 solid years of litigation on this breach of contract and bad faith claim. So, stay tuned here. It gets better, okay? So they file suit, District Court of Grady County, and the case goes to a jury trial. Okay, so they litigate this all the way to a jury. The conclusion of the jury trial, the jury comes back and finds for the plaintiffs, the Lynns, on a breach of contract for $566,000. They find for the plaintiffs, the Lynns, $650,000 in bad faith damages and another $250,000 in punitive damages. So I'm telling you, Grady County likes their cows and they believe they're ranchers. Okay. Yeah, so
apparently so.
You want to mess with the jury in Grady County? I don't know about that. So
yeah.
Anyway, so interesting jury verdict here coming up on appeal. So Farm Bureau is appealing the jury verdict, and the Supreme Court assigns it to the Court of Civil Appeals. there's several different issues that they bring up on appeal. And this is an opinion from Judge Thornbrew, and he typically does this in his opinions, which I think is typically I like to have a specific standard of review section because I think that's helpful. But when you've got different issues coming up, especially in a jury, from a jury trial, there can be different standards of review that are implicated. And so he does include a standard of review section here, but he says, look, there are several different standards of review, so we're going to discuss them as we discuss each of the issues. So the first issue that, and there's several in this case, and so I'm going to kind of hit the high ones that I think are the most interesting, frankly. The first issue is on an expert witness. Okay, so qualification of a Mr. Burl Daniel to serve as an expert witness to testify regarding insurance claims and handling. And so the trial judge lets him testify and qualifies him as an expert, and Farm Bureau is now appealing that. The Court of Civil Appeals says we're not going to reverse on this issue unless there's been a clear abuse of discretion by the trial judge. And the court basically says, look, Oklahoma has consistently recognized the assistance of experts in this area on the issue of handling of insurance claims, what's reasonable, whether there was bad faith in the case. So they affirm on that. And they say, any question with regard to Mr. Daniel's qualifications or the relevance of his qualifications and what his experience is, once he's allowed to come in and testify, then the jury, that's within their province to weigh his testimony and give it the relevance that they think it deserves. So no error with regard to the expert witness. So then the next issue brought up by Farm Bureau on the appeal is whether the trial court correctly denied their motion for a directed verdict. And as Judge Thornbrew points out, the review of a denial of a motion for a directed verdict is a de novo standard. So it's more of a question of law here that the court's looking at. So Farm Bureau's argument with regard to the directed verdict is that their Texas Ranger came in and looked at this, and he said there was absolutely no evidence of theft. And so we had a reasonable basis for denying this. And so there's no way we can be held liable for bad faith. And so Judge Thornbrew says, well, that's a little bit different than, what we've seen in the past with regard to a directed verdict. And so there was one case from 2009, the Andres case, which I think a lot of insurance defense folks are probably familiar with, where there was a question about the interpretation of the language of the policy. And it was a legal issue that states had gone different ways on. And, the court in that case said they had a reasonable basis for denying it. And so there was no bad faith there. But Judge Thornbrew says that's not really what's happening here in this case, because nobody disagrees that the policy, will pay out if there was a likely theft. And that's settled, basically. And really what we're looking at here is a disputed question of fact. And so that they say the trial court properly denied the directed verdict and let those disputes about the reasonableness of the insurance company's actions go to the jury. So there were a couple of other issues with regard to some of the evidence that the district court did not allow to come in to let the jury hear. So the two things that Farm Bureau brings up on appeal is that Mr. Lynn, who owned the operation, and one of his ranch hands were given polygraph tests as part of Farm Bureau's claims investigation. And the ranch hand, his test indicated he was telling the truth, but Mr. Lynn's test was inconclusive. The other thing that Farm Bureau wanted to be able to talk about with the jury was that these two tests, these two polygraph tests, were administered by agents of the United States Secret Service. So the judge in this case says, yeah, we're not going to talk about that in front of the jury. And he denies, he says he keeps the evidence out. And so Farm Bureau brings that up on appeal. And Judge Thornbruce says, look, the law's pretty settled in this area, even for civil cases. And as recently as 2009, the Oklahoma Supreme Court has said that polygraph evidence is inadmissible in both criminal and civil proceedings. And further, courts have frowned upon mentioning polygraph tests that have not been introduced into evidence, and any reference to such tests in the presence of the jury is discouraged. So they affirm here, and they say there was no error for the judge to keep this out. There was no error for the judge to keep out the fact that the Secret Service had administered the polygraph tests, because even a mention of that will eventually lead to opening the door to a discussion of what those polygraph tests look like. So well, that was an interesting aspect of this case. So the next two issues, and I won't spend a ton of time on them, jury instructions. Farm Bureau appealed a number of the jury instructions that the trial judge issued and several proposed instructions that Farm Bureau asked the court to use, and he did not use them. But the Court of Civil Appeals takes a look at all those and says, as a whole, we think the instructions that the court gave the jury, you know, accurately reflected Oklahoma law. And so we are not going to reverse on any of that. There was also an attorney's fee issue. The court affirmed there as well. The Lens also got some of their attorney's fees paid. I mean, I think this case is a good case to remind practitioners and listeners that if you get a case to a jury trial, when it goes up on appeal, appellate courts, are really... they're really deferential to jury verdicts. In the conclusion paragraph in this case, Judge Thornbruce says, look, it's clear from this record and the party's briefing that this was a difficult case that was replete with factual questions and credibility issues. And he says those issues are properly reserved for the jury in our system. And so really, when you're talking about the overall standard of review, when we're taking a look at a jury verdict on appeal, the jury verdict's conclusive as to all disputed facts and conflicting statements. And if there's any competent evidence that tends to support the verdict, the court on appeal is not going to disturb the jury's verdict or the trial court's judgment based thereon. So they're looking for things like prejudicial errors in the jury instructions or, you know, legal error on questions presented during trial. And unless you've got, a slam dunk on something like that, I think you're fighting an uphill battle appealing a jury verdict. But nevertheless, it's an interesting case. Not facts that we see all the time. This was affirmed, and it was a 3-0 decision from Judge Thornbrew. And this is another case where retired Justice Reeve from the Supreme Court was appointed to sit specially in this case because they had a vacancy at the time. So Judge Wiseman and Special Justice Reeve concur. And cert was denied by the Supreme Court on October the 5th in a 7-1 decision. Justice Kane dissented and Justice Roe did not participate in the vote.
Well, interesting outcome and definitely a good reminder that you're not going to be able to retry your case in the appeal. So make
That's
a good
right.
record and lay the groundwork for appealable issues. But just because you disagree with the jury verdict doesn't mean you're going to get any relief on appeal because of the deference that you mentioned is given on issues of facts and credibility. And
sure. Okay. And then finally, we have 2020 OK CIVAP 63, MidFirst Bank versus Poe. And this case was decided on October 23rd, and mandate was issued on December 2nd. And this case comes to us from Tulsa County. And I picked this case to talk about because this is not an issue that you see a lot of in the appellate opinions. And so I think it's interesting when we get something that that talks about it. And I think that's probably why the Court of Civil Appeals published it. So this is an interpleader action, and MidFirst Bank files a petition to interplead some funds that they were holding that they believed two people were disputing. So a Jennifer Poe and an Alice Poe. Alice was the personal representative of an estate, and the bank thinks that the funds are in dispute between these two individuals. And so they file a petition to interplead the funds into the court. And on the same day that they file the petition for interpleader, they present an order to the district court signing, and the district court signs the order directing the bank to deposit the funds with the court clerk. And the order's filed a couple days later. The named defendants, Ms. Poe and the other Ms. Poe, eventually get notice of this order. And Jennifer Poe comes in and says, wait a minute, I don't think these funds are in dispute. The personal representative is not disputing, you know, who's entitled to them. And so I'm going to object, and I'm going to file some counterclaims against MidFirst because I think they are operating with unclean hands and are liable for conversion. And so she also at the same time files a motion to vacate the order directing the bank to deposit the funds with the court clerk, and made an argument that the order was entered without notice and an opportunity for her to be heard. So the bank responds and says, well, we think that we could be subject to double liability, and so that's why we interpled the funds. And, you know, we don't think that you had to have notice on this deal for us to pay the funds into court. And they ask the court to dismiss her counterclaims and release them from the case and for attorney's fees. And the trial judge does all of those things for the bank. The trial court discharges them from the case and dismisses Ms. Poe's counterclaims and grants an award of attorney's fees to MidFirst Bank. And so there's three orders, I think, actually entered, and Ms. Poe appeals all of them, and the cases are made either consolidated or made companion cases, and the Court of Civil Appeals decides them all together. It does look like from the opinion that there was a question about whether the court had appellate jurisdiction of these orders. And the court says, yes, we think we do, because it was stemming from an order directing someone to pay money into court. And that's an interlocutory order that is appealable by right. And so we're going to go ahead and proceed on the jurisdictional issue and decide the case. So the court takes a look at the interpleader statute, which is found in Title 12, Section 2022. And it sets forth the procedure and the process that you go through when there's an interpleader filed. And really what the court talks about mostly is they say, look, before this statute was ever codified, this was an equitable power of the court to allow somebody to interplead funds into the court clerk's office and hold them until the dispute was resolved. And under all of that case law, how this typically operates, this procedure is with two successive litigations, essentially. And so the first set is, you know, whoever's holding the funds, the bank in this case, files the interpleader and names the defendants. And at that time, the court has to make a determination of whether the funds are in dispute and whether the bank could be subject to double liability if they pay it in error. And once that dispute has been resolved, then you move to the second stage of the litigation and you determine who's actually entitled to the disputed funds once the bank's out of the picture. And so this is an opinion from Judge Gorey, and he says, look, we can't find anything in the interpleader statute that says, you know, that takes away a defendant's right to object or to file an answer when they're brought into a case under the interpleader statute. And so we think just, you know, the civil procedure code applies, and that the defendant in this case, you know, was entitled to answer, was entitled to, you know, notice in a hearing. And so they actually say, because she didn't receive that in this case, there's in all likelihood a due process violation. And so they reverse all three orders and they send it back to the trial court and give instructions and say, you know, look, you need to first determine whether or not these funds are even disputed before you allow the bank to interplead them. And then once that determination is made, you can move forward with regard to whether they should have been paid into court and you know, who's entitled to them at that point. So again, reversed and remanded in a 3-0 opinion from Judge Gorey, Judge Bell and Judge Bittner concur, and no petition for cert was filed. So this one's going back for further proceedings.
Okay, well, we'll move now to our quick summaries of the other 6 cases that we didn't go into a lot of detail on. The first one that I'm going to talk about is 2020 OK Civ App 53, Nalis versus Dodson. This one was decided by Division 4 of the Court of Civil Appeals on an appeal of an application for attorney's fees coming out of Tulsa County. This case deals with 12 OS Section 936 and whether or not under the facts of the case that they implicated a contract relating to the purchase or sale of goods, in which case the prevailing party would be allowed a reasonable attorney fee. And that's what this case is about. And the court determined that under the facts of the dispute, it did implicate a contract relating to the purchase or sale of goods, and they reversed and remanded the case back to the trial court to determine a reasonable attorney's fee. 3-0 decision written by Judge Thornbrew. And so no petition for cert was unanimously denied as issued. So if you're interested in that topic, then that's a case you could go take a look at. The next one is 2020 OK Civ App 54, which is Schreck versus Reed, a case decided by Division 4 on an appeal of a partition order coming up out of Blaine County. Don't see a lot of partition issues in published opinions, so thought this was an interesting one. And the dispute between the parties in a court below was just their respective ownership of the property. There was no dispute that they were co-tenants in the property that was subject to partition, but one of the co-tenants was claiming that they were entitled to a larger share of the ownership because they'd been paying all the expenses relating to the property. And this case is interesting on a procedural note because the plaintiff filed a motion to convert the case into an accelerated appeal. So the defendant appealed the case. They were the appellant, and the appellee, the plaintiff in the court below, filed a motion after the petition error was filed to convert the case into an accelerated appeal. And the Supreme Court granted that motion and assigned the case to the accelerated docket and said it's to be governed by Rule 1.36, which is, you know, the accelerated appeal rule that is usually applied to appeals of a summary judgment. So no briefing, and they did it in this case, I think, because there really was no record from the court below other than the pleadings. The court had entered an order granting partition and appointing commissioners to assess the property and determine whether it could be partitioned in kind and in the alternative to set a value. And that was the order that was appealed because, again, one of the co-tenants was saying hey, I should be awarded more than 50% of the ownership because I've been paying all of the expenses. The case is affirmed on appeal in a 3-0 decision written by Judge Weissman, and cert was unanimously denied, and the Court of Civil Appeals effectively said, hey, the record owners owned in equal shares. If one of the co-tenants has been paying all of the expenses, that doesn't make them an owner of any more than their one half share, and they have to come up with some other avenue to recover their expenditures. But that's an issue left for another day and another mechanism, not the partition procedure.
Interesting. So, makes sense.
Yeah. Final case that I'm going to talk about in summary fashion is 2020 OK CIVAP 55, Mineral Acquisitions versus Ham, decided by Division 4 of the Court of Civil Appeals on an appeal of summary judgment coming up from Oklahoma County. This is a continuation of the 2014 divorce saga between Sue Ann Arnold and the Continental Resources founder, Harold Ham. Listeners probably remember that divorce case, and the special judge in the divorce case granted Sue Ann Arnold a division of assets of about $1 billion, and Harold Ham wrote a check out for $1 billion, and Sue Ann Arnold had appealed the ruling, but deposited the check, and the Supreme Court dismissed her appeal as moot because she'd accepted the benefit of the trial verdict. Well, this appears to be Sue Ann Arnold taking another shot at getting some more money from her former husband, Harold Ham, and she sues in her own name and in a derivative action on behalf of this Mineral Acquisitions LLC, of which she and Harold Ham were each 50-50 owners. And just a brief recitation of the facts: Mineral Acquisitions LLC, through a subsidiary, acquired mineral interests in North Dakota and operated a well in North Dakota. And they acquired these interests in 2001, I believe, or sometime thereabouts. And they apparently had a book value of $4.5 million. Well, in 2005, Mineral Acquisitions LLC sold all of its assets, these minerals and this operated well, to Continental Resources for book value of $4.5 million, which probably something close to what they actually paid for these minerals. Well, Arnold claims that the minerals are actually worth $900 million and that Ham breached his fiduciary duties to her and to the LLC for selling the assets to Continental Resources at book value of $4.5 million. And then Ham apparently took some steps to dissolve the LLC and stopped filing the annual reports, and the LLC was actually terminated a few years later. Well, Arnold says that she only discovered that she was a 50-50 owner of this LLC and only learned about this transaction where it sold $900 million of assets to Continental Resources for $4.5 million during the divorce proceedings. And so she files after the divorce is granted and the appeal is dismissed and the case is final. She then brings this lawsuit in 2015. Well, the court below dismissed the lawsuit on Ham's motion on two grounds. One, re judicata, which is, I guess, now called claim preclusion, essentially arguing that these are claims that should have been asserted in the divorce. These assets were dealt with in the divorce, divided up in the divorce, should have made these claims in the divorce case, and also statute of limitations, because these transactions and the existence of this LLC and the sale of these assets to Continental Resources were all disclosed in public filings made going back 9 years ago. And so you have a 5-year statute of limitation and it's run. And the trial court used those two bases to throw the case out. And the appellate court agrees and says trial court below was right. And in addition, the derivative claims brought on behalf of Mineral Acquisitions LLC can't stand because Mineral Acquisitions LLC hasn't existed for several years. So there was no effort made to revive it prior to bringing suit. So it has no standing to make a claim. So its claims are dismissed as well. So 3-0 affirmed. Judge Hickson authors the opinion. Interestingly, no petition for cert filed. You would think in a case like this, with the amount of money involved and the litigious nature of the parties, that this one would go all the way to the bitter end. But maybe they resolved it before, agreed not to file cert as a part of some settlement. I have no idea, just speculation. But okay, that was maybe a little more than a quick summary, but I thought it was kind of interesting, just because of the history and the background and the parties. But there you go. That's the result.
Okay, well, I've got three more that I'll just do a quick summary on. And if you practice in these areas, then you might want to go take a look at them in more detail. The first one is 2020 OK Civ App 58, in re the Marriage of Clements. And this case is the wife's entitlement to a retirement benefit of the husband that accrued during a portion of their marriage, but that had not vested at the time of the divorce. And then, 15, 18 years later, he vests in the retirement system, and she, wants to know what percentage of the retirement she gets. It's really an interpretation of the divorce decree and what the wife's entitled to, and then the subsequent issue on how to draft the qualified domestic relations order to send to the third party administrator who's administering the retirement benefits. So any family law practitioners out there might want to take a look at this one. Interesting discussion on interpreting this divorce decree. So okay, then we have 2020 OK Civ App 60. This is PNC Bank versus Unknown Successor Trustees. And this is a statute of limitations issue in a foreclosure of a mortgage that secures a line of credit payable in installments. So pretty specific issue here in a mortgage foreclosure practice area. So if you do a lot of those, probably a good case to take a look at. Then finally, we have in the matter of the protest of denial of sales tax claim, 2020 OK Civ App 61. And this also is a statute of limitations issue. This is whether a new statute that shortens the time to apply for a refund of overpayment of taxes can be applied retroactively. And without going too far into detail, in an opinion from Judge Gorey, he says no, you can't apply it retroactively because you have a vested interest essentially at the time you pay your taxes. And in this case specifically, the claimant originally had 3 years to file for any refund, but a statute was passed in shortening that time to 2 years. And so the Court of Civil Appeals says the 3-year statute of limitations applies and you can't apply this amendment retroactively.
All right, excellent. Well, I think that brings us to the end of our review of cases published by the Court of Civil Appeals from August 2020 through the end of 2020. So a lot of information in there. Hope everybody got a little something out of one or two of those cases that they can use in their practice. And with that, we'll bring the show to a close. And you can go check out the show's website at oklahomaappeals.com. Sign up to receive notices of new editions of the podcast and case notes emailed out to you so you know what cases we're going to discuss. And also follow the show on Twitter at Oklahoma Appeals, where we post court news and other items of interest for Oklahoma lawyers. We'll be back with a new episode every other Wednesday. And until next time, bye-bye.